I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Small, meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Jessica Banks is the founder and CEO of Rock Paper Robot, a company at the intersection of design, technology, and decor. RPR's products are rousing the sleepy furniture industry by leveraging physics and robotics to enhance versatility and functionality without sacrificing aesthetics. I'm an investor in your company. Yeah. And one of the things that I, you know, where I meet all these people is that I met you at a wedding.
You did indeed.
You know, which is such a funny thing, you know, and you were the rabbi preacher,
the officiant
yeah. of wedding, yeah. And all three of you, you being the
officiant,
yeah. whatever, you Both. Know, the overseer, uh-huh. We're all standing on top of that piece and all sobbing.
Sobbing.
And then later I was introduced to you and told me about your company. And I was like, oh, I love that. Come talk to me.
And I really, when I met you guys, you were standing with Fred and I remember thinking, okay, hi. And after that, people were like, oh, you know, congratulations. Good job. Do you do this for other weddings? And I was like, I was sobbing, right? Like, clearly these people are close to me. Like, no, I'm not. This is not what I just do, right?
Yeah.
And so I was like taken aback. But then when I met you guys, I was so glad that I didn't know who you were first because I would have been super nervous, right?
That's so funny.
Like, very. And I don't get intimidated. Like, I worked with celebrities and whatever. I don't get intimidated. But if I would have known it was you two, I would have been like, oh my gosh. You
know? That's so funny.
Yeah.
That's so funny because I don't think of myself like that whatsoever. So let's go back because I think your whole history is so amazing. So you're a Wisconsin girl.
I am. Proud of it.
So you graduated college.
I went to University of Michigan.
And which, you know, hail to the Victor Valiants. Because my father was a teacher there, a professor, so I know the songs.
Nice.
And then you followed a guy.
I did. Yeah. So in college, I did physics and astrophysics. I'd always wanted to be an astronaut.
That's
when
right.
I was younger.
You wanted to be an astronaut.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go to college, do astrophysics. I'm going to go into the military. I really wanted to fly the shuttle. You have to go into the military and fly combat. And so after college, I graduated. I met with my a liaison officer. I actually came to New York because I was dating a guy at the time. I'd come to New York thinking I'm still going to go into the military. And then realized that wasn't basically going to happen, right? I was a quarter of an inch too short.
Right, you were too short.
I stretched myself.
Yoga can help with that.
And also waking up and getting measured in the morning helps. But yes, it's true. And then I basically was like, it was very clear that it wouldn't be the right
thing. And did they tell you you will not be happy being an astronaut?
Not being happy being an astronaut, it became clear in my conversations that I was not cut out for the military. When I would ask questions like, okay, if I don't like it, can I stop? Can I return it, my education? And he was like, it's going to cost millions of dollars to train you, right, to fly combat. And I was like, well, what if I fly over Israel and I'm supposed to drop a bomb or do something and I don't want to? He's like, you can't even ask those questions, right?
You're here to follow orders.
Exactly. And it became really clear, you know.
So you decided no astronaut.
I decided no astronaut. And I had also done creative writing undergrad. And so I thought, you know, I'll just do that. I'll think about doing some comedy, writing comedy, something like this. The boy I was dating is a comedian. And so, you know, I was like, comedy's funny. I'll do that. And ended up working at Comedy Central, entry level position. But really, I was like, what am I going to do on Earth? I didn't expect to have a terrestrial future, right? So I was like, what on Earth am I going to do on Earth? So then it just became a really weird meandering path.
But you ended up booking comedians.
I was doing, managing comedians.
And so how long did you do that for?
Like a year and a half or 2 years or something like that.
And when did you come to the conclusion this was not your future?
I right when I started. So basically, yeah, it wasn't a conclusion. It was like, this is happening now, right?
Right. And so you're in it. It's paying your income. You're paying your rent. And then you finally decide, I'm out of here.
Right. And then, yeah, I went to work for Al Franken, who I was his personal assistant. We worked on a TV show out in LA, back and forth.
So you work for Al Franken, who I absolutely think is fantastic.
Fantastic.
I mean, super smart man. I'd like to see him run for president.
I would too.
But I don't know if that's going to happen. And so you decided, all right, I gotta get out of this. What am I going to do?
Well, it wasn't exactly like, what am I? So I actually, we were in LA filming the show for Al, and I saw a movie by Errol Morris, a documentary called Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. It's about a lion tamer, a topiarist who carves trees into shapes, a naked mole rat specialist, and a roboticist. And I was like, roboticist, like, that's cool. And they like showcased MIT and all this stuff. And there was a woman in the movie, and I was like, I'm a girl. I could be a girl in robotics. It's like, and it's like physics and sculpture. This is great. And so when I came back from LA, I was like, I'm going to apply to grad school in robotics. And I ended up applying to MIT. Now, I had forgotten who was in the movie, you know. Turned out when I went on MIT website, it was like Rod Brooks, you know, head of the AI lab and the robotics group, you know, is just in Errol Morris's movie. And I was like, oh, so cool. I'm going to go here. And so I applied. And then a couple months later, I got a call. Rod Brooks would like you to join his lab. And the girl in the movie ended up to be my office mate.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, but you ended up at MIT, and on day two, didn't you call your sister and say?
Oh gosh, I was. Yeah, it was actually right even before the classes started. We had a, you know, like an introduction weekend where you go up and you meet people. And I remember walking into the room and seeing a group of people who I just felt like I was never going to jive with. I called my sister and I was like, "I'm coming home." She's like, "You will stay one night," and I was like, "I will not." She was in New York and I was in Boston, And I ended up staying for a night, and I came home early because I was so mortified. And I was like, I'm going to repress that this is ever going to happen. When it happens, I'm going to go to school. That's just, you know. And so, but I was really nervous about the
social scene. It's an interesting social scene. I mean, you know, Fred went to MIT, and I went to school in Boston, mm-hmm. and I spent plenty of days on MIT's campus. And it's a unbelievable place, but it's a very a lot of very smart people there.
Well said.
Right. And so you ended up staying at MIT for?
Almost 8 years.
That's what I thought. Right. Yeah. And so you went through what programs?
So I was in the Artificial Intelligence Lab, Computer Science and AI Lab, in the Humanoid Robotics Group. I got my master's and electrical engineer's degree, and I was all but dissertation for my PhD. I also did a minor in biology, which was really cool. And then I taught there in their civil and environmental engineering department and built a lab. They didn't have an electronics lab. I was like, you guys need to be sensing the buildings and sensing the world. And so I built the lab from like down to the very stools they sit on.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
But cool. You went on to get your PhD until you
left
decided.
Left right before my PhD.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Left right before my PhD. I think I was like I was like in the 24th grade or something. And I wasn't in it for the PhD. I wasn't in it for the degree. And I felt like I had not, I can always learn more, but I wasn't really flourishing in that atmosphere anymore. I came to New York and I was a fellow at iBeam, which is Art and Technology Center.
Right, which is an amazing place.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, which is probably a little more in your social realm.
Yeah, much more. Yeah.
And it was at iBeam that you came up with Rock, Paper, Robot.
Mm-hmm. I had inklings of, you know, some of the designs before, but there I started to really experiment and test and be able to think about what I wanted to do. And then thought, you know, oh, I have a company. But, still then it was a twinkle. I didn't know what that would mean to have a company. As if today I'm still learning exactly what it means every day. That's when I started to think about it.
And what was the first product that you started to work on there?
It was our levitating tables,
right.
Float table. And so started making those and very, you know, high-end functional art pieces. It took years to really develop that well to a point where we can now make them and
in mass if you wanted to. Right. And then, you know, talk about the journey of how, okay, now I have this beautiful levitating table that people want. And what else can I do and what other products?
Right. So I had really always felt that I wanted to do kinetic furniture. When I was at MIT, I basically learned how to build and also how to start to make things move. And I'm like, I can make the static objects of our world have more abilities if they are moving around and responsive. And that was what is my goal and really excited me to think about it. So after I just started doing the high-end things, I thought, now let's figure out how to do stuff that's really filling a pain point.
Right. And also think about how you can build a company that has products that can sell to the masses.
Exactly.
Right. So you had to be at a certain price point.
Right.
But you're also have a pain point of how did you make these products work and get people to manufacture them, because they're not that simple.
Yes. I mean, traditional furniture makers and manufacturers have had trouble digesting the designs because they are used to static things. And so we have to look at a lot of different manufacturing types and people with different abilities to be able to do this. It's, you know, we build things that are kind of more like transmissions and have embedded sensors now. And so that's an obstacle for traditional furniture making.
It is. Down the line, eventually, I think it would probably make sense that you're completely vertical because it is a very different kind of furniture making.
Right.
So talk about the products that you are in now and, you know, what you've learned along the line. It's not been easy.
Right. No. And, you know, it's not been easy for, I think, many ways, many different reasons. One is, you know, bringing new ideas into the world, you end up, you know, having all these areas of discomfort, right? Because the world isn't shaped that way. But right now we're really focused on a chair that can retract with the pull of a string. It's called our Ollie chair. And there's a whole line of Ollie products that are coming out, tables, bar stools, other coffee tables and things like that.
Which is perfect for small living.
Perfect.
Small, which yes. is where we're going.
Exactly. And even just more, not even small living in terms of space, but big living in terms of experience.
Right. Right.
And that's what to me is really cool. Like be able to do whatever you want and don't have your lives be described by the furniture, the static things in them. You should, you know, be able to determine what your spaces are at any given time.
So there's flexibility to
them. Flexibility and customization.
Right. Particularly because the pieces are flat and then they become something.
Right.
And so all of a sudden you have something lying on the floor and you pull something and you've got a chair or you're going to have a table.
Tables.
Right. And so you can use them depending on how you feel that day.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, ultimately then, I mean, this is just the beginning. We started off doing, you know, they're human powered, but we have versions now that we're working on that are robotic and sensor based. So imagine you have tables that can come out of the wall based on data that you have about, you know, if you're a cafe and you have foot traffic pattern data correlated with revenue and you're like, oh, it's 10 a.m. We need to have a lot of people get around in here. That's a high revenue point for us. Let's make sure we optimize for that. You know, and later at 4, you want some recurring revenue and, you know, tables are coming down because you want people to stay and sit and, you know, it's a different time.
So the changing of your environments with furniture through technology.
Right.
Right. Which is really interesting, which is out there.
Yeah.
But we're going there.
Yes.
Right. And then the other piece that you've created, which I think is phenomenal, is the table.
Thank you.
You know, which is lies flat against a wall and that you're able to literally pull out. I mean, you could do 20 feet.
You'd have to have a very high ceiling to be able to do that.
Right. You know? That would be the only issue.
That's the thing. But and you can change the whole surface. So you can do whiteboard for schools. You can do game boards. You can do if you have a brick wall or wallpaper, you know, ultimately we want to be able to, you know, upload a picture of that and we'll print it out. So it camouflages in when the table is stored. Advertising for commercial spaces and then freestanding versions as well. And so that's, you know, we're going to be really focusing on. It's funny, like that was really when we met, we talked about that table, right? And that was exciting. And, you know, we realized, well, we can do the chair put the chair into market much faster. And so that's what we were focused on.
And it's also much more consumer oriented. I mean, you look at the chair, you did a Kickstarter project.
Yeah.
And consumers love the chair. I mean, it's a beautiful chair. It makes sense. You don't have to know all the intimacy about the chair, but you know how it works. You know, where that table is really a great application. It can be obviously for small apartments, but it's a great application for businesses.
B2B, right.
Yeah. I mean, from boats to hospitals to you
name
it.
Hotels, and we're working on a bed version too. So there can be a mechanism where you can actually lower the whole thing and then pull it out.
I mean, it would be great for masseuses.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, all of those different things.
Yeah.
And so the biggest challenge has really been manufacturing.
Biggest is hard for me. Like everything feels huge as a challenge, but manufacturing was a rough one. Yeah. And finally, you know, we started off overseas, met a manufacturer in Canada, and I decided to switch. It was really one of those moments where I felt like CEO decision maker, like I have to make a decision because I think that this is a better path ultimately, even though there was sunk cost. You know, I was like, wow, this is a huge turning point for me as
yes.
well. And you know, it's taken a bit. They've been, you know, we've been getting up to speed and finally now have hit a point where we've started shipping and production is working. But there were some very, very rough points. And I think that was also me not even knowing how to vet the right partner. Someone who's super enthusiastic and promises all this stuff and says they can. There were things now I've learned that I should have just checked. Like, you know, even if you say you're going to rent this new warehouse thing, da da da, and like I should have seen, like, well, like, show me what your fulfillment system is like. You know, they do a lot of B2B. It's very different to do a direct to consumer
right.
product.
Well, I think that that is how the world works as a whole. I mean, people are, you know, they want to please. Really successful people also tend to be good salespeople. They're selling themselves, they're selling mm-hmm. their products. People get them excited. They have great auras.
Right.
And then, you know, you sign the contract and you get down into the nitty gritty and it's just like, uh-oh.
Right.
Yeah. And so I totally get it. But you did make the right call, you know, making a shift to a manufacturer because the chairs have been shipped.
Yeah. They're shipping. And the next batch next week ships and we'll fulfill all the Kickstarter on time.
Which is great. And what are you getting feedback from?
So amazing. Okay, like we had one person that had like a foot fall off, and that has been the only bad thing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really great.
And so we've about 400, over 400 have shipped. Like people are sending me pictures of their chairs in their homes, like in Hawaii and, you know, like out on their lawn and, you know, all kinds of things. And they're like, I love it, but my brother took it. You know, like, so I need another. And it's really cool.
That is really, really cool. And are yeah. you going to continue to sell those on your site?
Yeah. We're launching our e-com. We had to wait. Part of the reason that I was frustrated with our manufacturers because we had to wait till we had inventory to be able to launch our e-commerce site.
Right. Because people want
right
them
away.
Now.
And you want to be able to fulfill quickly. Otherwise, it hurts your brand, right? And so now we'll finally have inventory after the end of next week. And we already built the site and we are waiting on it.
It's interesting what you said about it hurts your inventory. I was having a conversation with an entrepreneur about this, about these pop-up stores that happen at Christmas. And a lot of the inventories that some of these companies carry, they don't. They are fulfilled from someone else that they have put up on their site. And so if they have an event and they can't walk away with the chair, particularly the holiday season, they're not interested.
Right.
They don't want it to show up 15 days later.
Exactly.
And I think I agree with you. I think that people, when they make that purchase, there is an instantaneous gratification that they can see, I'm going to receive this in so many days.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a psychological momentum too, right? You start to expect it, which is what's weird with Kickstarter. They've managed to do a different kind of thing, which is like, you know, but you're going to wait and it's going to be worth the wait because you're getting something special, right? They managed to do it. And of course, there are extended times where people get frustrated.
Right.
And I don't think you can. It was very important for me to at least fulfill on time, right? I think people, even when they do a Kickstarter, they're like, whatever, everyone at Kickstarter is late. And I was like, I'm not.
I wonder what percentage of people on Kickstarter are late.
I think in like well above 70.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, but it is interesting. Many of the products on there are very artistic. Most of the people have never produced anything in their lives. And you feel like you're getting something so unique and so special. You're so cutting edge that you're willing to put the money in and support someone who's making the pledge to you on some video and then, you know, waiting it out. I mean, I've gotten Kickstarter projects so late that I'm like, oh my God.
I ordered this.
Totally. Oh, they made it.
Exactly.
Great.
Totally.
Yeah, that's really great. So you're going to launch Rock Paper Robots Shop.
E-commerce, yeah.
E-commerce, and mm-hmm. you're going to have the chairs in there.
So we'll roll out each of the products as we get it. And we always start B2B first. It's a good sampling, and it also allows us to hone all the things before you start to send out to consumers.
Right.
You know, I'd like to stay B2B, actually. I think it's easier.
It is an easier business.
Much easier. That was my real goal, was to do B2B and licensing. But you really have to have street cred first, and you have to build the brand. So in order to do that, I was like, oh no, we have to make something, and we have to make it at scale so that people see we're serious and we make things that are, you know, for a huge demographic, like a global demographic that they're loved.
Right. Yeah. Well, that is interesting about B2B. And B2B is much more easy because you're not dealing with a consumer. You're letting them deal with a mm-hmm. consumer, but everyone wants to know you have a brand. You know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You can actually create a product, so which is what you did with the chair.
Right.
And so now, how long has Rock, Paper, Robot been around?
I said, you know, really, since when we raised money in 2014. So, you know, it's 3 years now.
It's not that long.
It's not that long. I started it before, but I didn't know what that – I wasn't starting it.
Thinking about it.
Yeah.
Which I think that most people do. I mean, I think the success of most businesses, if you go and talk to someone, I mean, Perry Chan is a perfect example of Kickstarter. Mm. He'd been thinking about this for 10 years before he actually went out and started that business.
Yeah.
You know, I know Jessamyn Waldman, now Jessamyn Rodriguez at Hot Bread Kitchen. She had been thinking about that concept for a long time before she actually went and started that business.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's one of the fallacies about the industry of startups is that, oh, you come up with this great idea, you get funding, and boom!
Exactly.
You know, it takes a long, long time.
Yeah. I can't actually even believe how long it takes, you know, because I'm like, I can, you know, if I want to get something done, I can get it done fairly quickly. Having a business is different. You're on a different time dilated scale, right? Often. And it's like, I can't believe. And I even watched outside of our window of our office. They filmed this movie, The Greatest Showman, okay? They built a village, like from the 18th century or something, right? They built an entire village, filmed this movie over a couple, like, month, burned it down because there was a scene and whatever. And I watched, and at first I thought that they were actually building a real building. I didn't realize it was a facade. But I got so upset because I was like, they just built a building in, you know, 2 months, and I can't make a chair. It takes me a year to make a chair.
Right.
You know, I was like, this is not right. I learned it was for a movie and it made me feel better. But there's a different thing. Like, it really takes so long to coordinate the world to agree and coalesce with your idea.
Yeah. It takes so much longer and, you know, a lot of testing. You know, I had a board meeting today with the company, and what is now happening in that product was exactly what she wanted to happen from day one, but it took this long for the industry to embrace the product mm-hmm. at that stage.
Yeah.
You know, and so it almost has to be a perfect storm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no, building a business is a very, very hard thing. And then you have to deal with people and hiring the right people.
Dealing with people is really rough. Turns out.
It is really rough.
Turns out the thing we take for granted almost every day.
Well, also, at the beginning, you end up hiring people that breathe. And then you hire other people that actually can do the product.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hire people that are super senior people because you know exactly what you need.
Right.
And you see this time and time again with companies. Like, the first 10 people generally are not the people that are going to be around in the next round because they were good, but very few of them scale upward.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you're kind of at that level.
Right. And so, you know, now I think what we've done, which is so exciting, is we brought on a team, like the A team in the furniture industry, right, as advisors, board member, who are going to help us, like, lead this whole thing. But already I see the effects of it. Like, and it's been, like, a couple months where and we're just finalizing it. But it's so important to have the people now I see who have the experience. And I do think that it's a mix. You know, at first I thought, oh, no, I need furniture salespeople. You know, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily, but I realize where it helps. You know, where it helps to have the connections of somebody who knows other people in the furniture industry.
Yes.
Where it helps to have a fulfillment center that does bulky objects, right?
Yes.
And, like, you know, I've talked to so many and they're like, oh, well, we're expecting, you know, we do deals where companies are shipping 20,000 units a month. And I was like, that would be, what would hold that? for us, you know, like we have big pieces.
Right.
And so, and it's a different kind of thing. You know, people aren't used to like kinetic furniture, but I think you have, starting at the basic level, as we are furniture. Let's, you know.
You are furniture. Okay. Right. You might have an incredible cool table that has not easy to make it, really thoughtful about how you get there, lots of technology, lots of magic, but it's a table.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what kills me, is like, I'm making a chair, you know, like, you know, and if I thought I would go to MIT for 8 years and then make a chair,
you might have told myself. Yeah. but you're making a very interesting chair.
Thank you.
You know, and the chairs are super cool. Oh, and all the furniture is very unique and different than anything else that you're seeing out there. I mean, there's a million couches.
So, and this is a surprise, which I'll tell you, and who knows if this will happen, but we've been starting to talk to a company in Europe who saw our stuff, and they were like, we want to change transportation in our country. And so, you know, there are subway lines, business trains, things like this. And we are now talking about engaging with them on a humongous project.
Because
like
it's
government level.
Right. That's amazing.
Right.
That's because it's kinetic furniture. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you need to stay focused.
Thanks.
I mean, this is such a big concept and idea, and what you're doing, really no one else is thinking about this, or you would not have a country talking to you, you know. But I think that is one of the lessons learned too, is focus. Focus, absolutely. Focus, focus. And I think, you know, there's so many people that I talk to that say, you know, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and we have these 19 products. And it's just like, okay, you're not even a year into the business. There's no way you're going to do that. And it's hard not to think that
way. It's hard not to. And I think you kind of have to, because if you don't have that excitement of the big picture and like to feeling like you have to run, you can't stay in the game, right? But you have to execute, you have to focus. And
yes.
Now, like then, after the Kickstarter, it really taught me, like, we're doing this chair.
That's
full
it.
Full stop. Like,
right.
We're just getting this to the market, you know? And it was like, really, you know, the way I even looked at emails, the way I even looked at every other thing, I was like, is it related? No. Stop. Like, and, you know, and it was something that you have been, you know, pushing on me as like how to do that. The Kickstarter
made you
as
do it.
Well, really did.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think that you need to plot a roadmap. And sometimes those big ideas, you put them on your roadmap and they might be 24 months from there. And, you know, if you start hitting the milestones, you can maybe compress that and get it quicker. But if they start, you know, coming in at the 8 month level, you have to say no.
Right.
Because then nothing gets done.
Right. Exactly. And like you can, I think being CEO is very much about like course correcting, you know, and being agile, right? Okay, oh, I see this. Now let's switch. But you have to keep heading in the same direction, right, as you course correct. And instead of
it's just
of, like,
a curvy path.
It's super, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the key to successful entrepreneur is that, you know, you have to make a right-hand turn on Tuesday morning, but you might have to make a left-hand turn on Wednesday afternoon, and that's okay.
Lefts. Okay,
yeah. But at least, you know, you're moving forward. You're not like making that left-hand turn and being behind the right-hand turn.
Yeah.
And that's the key.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to Jessica for joining us this week and sharing her story with us. You can check her out at Rock Paper Robot and all their products at rockpaperrobot.com. Thank you to all you listeners for joining us this week. Stay up to date with Positively Gotham Gal. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can subscribe to our podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. We will see you next week.